IPTV's Dan Wardell and musician and mailman Jim Seek grew up together. Now they've been reunited on IPTV Kids Clubhouse, making fun and educational music for the children of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, music for kids. I'll talk with Dan Wardell and Jim Seek about the music of Dr. Notable and why music is an important element of IPTV Kids Clubhouse. I'll also talk with music therapist Elaine Reschke-Hernandez about the power of music as children develop and how parents and educators can harness that power. And finally, we'll get some recommendation for some great new music for kids. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, music for kids. Later in the hour, I'll talk with a music therapist about the power of music as children develop, and we will get some recommendations for some great new releases for kids. But first, IPTV Kids Clubhouse saw an important addition to the cast in season two. His name is Dr. Notable, and he makes music. Dr. Notable is played by musician and Waverly mailman Jim Seek. Jim and IPTV Kids Clubhouse host Dan Wardell grew up together, made music together, and now they are making music for the children of Iowa on public television. And this is Dr. Notable November. IPTV Kids Clubhouse is sharing Dr. Notable's music online in sing-along videos. And let's hear a little sample of Dr. Notable's music. This is the Danbot Robo Trot.
A bucket of bolts and a pile of wire. Oh. The Danbot came to be assistant to a man named Dan at the turn of the century. Among his many talents is his own special move. Just acting, his dancing chip, and he lights up any room. Doing the dance by Robo Trot, rotate left, rotate right.
Just a sample of the Danbot Robo Trot, and Dan Wardell and Jim Seek are here with me now. Hello, Dan.
Hey, good morning, Charity. Thanks for having me back.
Well, thank you for being here. Hello, Jim.
Good morning. I'm really thrilled to be here. I'm a long-time listener and first-time caller today, so very excited.
Well, it's great to have you both here. And Dan, tell me, you guys grew up together, right? When did you become friends?
Well, we grew up in Maynard, West Central. We went to school at West Central High School, and we lived on farms about 2 miles away. And the funny thing about the story is Jim and I were actually arch enemies most of our childhood. I was actually best friends with his little brother, Joel Zeek, and Jim's 1 year older than us. And so Jim and I were at odds with each other, because when we go over to someone's house, Joel and I would be, you know, against Jim and his buddies. And so it wasn't until later in high school, maybe our junior or senior year, that we realized that maybe it would be better if we combined forces, and instead of being arch enemies, we became best buds.
All right. And what kinds of stuff did you do together? Because you were both musical. You both liked to create. Jim, what did you and Dan do together once you combined forces?
Well, usually when someone asks me about my youthful adventures with Dan, the first question I shoot back is, are you wearing a wire? But we really connected on just crazy characters that we like, but we would get together on the weekends, and I can remember Dan drove this big yellow car, four-door yellow car. It was about three times as big as any other passenger car, and we would drive into nearby Owine and cruise the strip, as they say, and went on many adventures. That was pretty much our weekend. We were always having a good time.
All right. And there was a little music involved in that, right, Dan?
Yeah, you know, we got closer and closer and realized that maybe there were some talents we could share with the world. And so I remember one of the first things we did is we created a play. We tried to convince the Maynard Public Library to let us do a play. I think, if I remember correctly, it was a story about Jack and the Beanstalk, a reimagined version. And there was some music involved. And I think maybe, if I'm not mistaken, Jim, we had maybe 15 people in the crowd when we did that first performance. And once you get a taste of that, Charity, you don't come back.
All right.
That sounds about right. And I believe our chorus teacher was there in attendance. And I was nervous, but I was very excited that she gave me the thumbs up that we were trying some music and some of this crazy stuff.
So, Jim, how did you get involved in IPTV Kids Clubhouse?
Well, that's a long story, but just being friends with Dan and connected with him, obviously I've watched IPTV for years. It was always on in our house. My dad's a retired farmer. Every Friday night, you know, don't get in the way of the TV when Market to Market's on or there's going to be consequences. And every show like that. So I followed it, and it was just basically keeping in touch with Dan and some of the different shows where we went on and did some radio shows and things. And when he got onto putting together his show, then he gave me a call, and it was a real thrill.
And you created the theme song for the show, right?
Yes, that was the first adventure with it. And I remember getting a call from him and kind of hang up and thought, well, I'll sure try. I don't know. It had been a while since I worked on anything. And just kind of hashed it out and sent him some music, like a rough demo. I think it was about a 5-minute song. And Dan said, that's great. We need about 30 seconds. And so we kind of went back and forth and came to an end, which was really positive.
So, Dan, how did the idea for the character, Dr. Notable, come about?
Oh, what a fun question, because when we decided that everybody loved the theme song, and it was the first thing people experienced, and it really made an impression, we thought, you know what, okay, we're going to ask for some songs for season two. What we didn't know was who or what was going to actually be conveying those songs. We knew Jim was going to write the music, we knew Jim was going to sing the music, but I probably spent every night for 2 months just banging my head against the wall trying to create a puppet that would be the likeness, would be Dr. Notable. And I had foam and cardboard and construction paper and glue, and I mean, I just couldn't do it. I couldn't create a puppet that could convey the emotions and the articulation. And finally, I went to our executive producer, Deb Herbold, and I said, Deb, I think Dr. Notable actually needs to be a real life character as opposed to so many puppets that we have on the show. And we then someone was originally going to lip sync and pretend to be Jim as Dr. Notable, and that didn't work. And so finally, we said, hey, let's give him a shot. Let's give Jim a shot. Bring him on in. But I told Deb, I said, Deb, you got to be prepared, because if you bring him in, I know everybody's going to love him. He's such a colorful character and such a great singer. And sure enough, he came in and did a demo for us in his Dr. Notable outfit, and the rest is history. There's no turning back now, Jim, Dr. Notable.
Well, and so we got to talk about this outfit. This is a pretty flamboyant outfit. Jim, you put that together yourself? The purple with the top hat, et cetera?
Well, I gave it the thumbs up, but I think the wonderful production crew there with Dan kind of threw out the ideas of the flashy suit and the hat, and I was proud to wear it, being a big fan of some of the crazy Elton John 1970s outfits.
It could be an Elton John hand-me-down.
Oh, that's a great compliment. Yeah.
So, in creating the character Dr. Notable, Jim, do you feel like this is a representation of you on stage, or did you have to look somewhere else to create this character?
It probably is a representation of me. People that I work with, people that I know, would think that is probably the last thing I'm involved in, is any kind of kid show like that, anything really wacky. But I guess. Maybe I should talk to someone about that, like I have an alter ego or something. But that's the way it all came out. That's that's the way the songs came out, you know. I guess when you're a kid inside, it doesn't matter what your age, it's going to come out the way it's going to come out.
Well, and Dan, I know that a whole lot of research goes into IPTV Kids Clubhouse, and I know that you're very passionate about music. Give me an idea of what kind of research and preparation you and Jim did to bring these songs to life and to connect with kids.
Well, in season one, that was the one thing we didn't have. We didn't have a music segment. And, you know, my love of kids stuff goes way, way back, whether it be, you know, Sesame Street or Zubily Zoo or Mr. Rogers. There was always some kind of little music element that was always over the top, which was always something that gave you a different opportunity to learn something in a different way. And we just didn't have that opportunity during season one. It happened so fast. And when season two happened and we realized, hey, we had an option to add some musical segments in there, it was like, whoa, where do we even start? And so there was a lot of sit-down time and thinking and researching. And you know, there's so many songs. He wrote 8 songs for that second season. And, you know, there's songs that are called Pluto's Plight, which actually teaches a science lesson about Pluto and how it was revoked from being a planet by the planetary committee. And there's social-emotional songs in there that are just kind of more simple, feel-good love songs like A Jammy Time about families getting ready for bed and being tucked in bed at night and things like that. One of the songs that Jim wrote was called A World Without Vowels. And it's basically a very simple English lesson that teaches kids what A, E, I, and O and U are and what would happen to the world if they just simply disappeared.
Well, and the songs, we played the Dan Butt Robo Trot, which is a very upbeat song. We're going to play another one here in just a couple of minutes. Also one of the more upbeat, but I mean, some of them are very... very low-key songs, very sweet-sounding. The Pluto song's a little bit sad. What is there an idea of how you want these songs to sound?
You know, they just kind of they come out the way they come out. You try certain melodies, certain chords, and if it mashes up with the lyrics, okay. You know, you just try it and send it on. It just seemed like, a real fast dance song about Pluto being kicked out of the planetary group didn't seem to fit. So a little more of a ballad type thing, and it seemed to work pretty good.
What are your plans for music on the show in the future, Dan?
We've already had the luxury of being given 5 demo songs from Jim for season 3. One which the whole staff is super excited about is called Opera Frog for our theater episode, and it's a huge bombastic epic song, kind of a little bit like Pluto's Plight, but more majestic and definitely not sad. But it, you know, how the Opera Frog came to power in the theater circuit. So Jim's already given us some magic to work with. You know, Charity, one of the things that was, to be honest, a little bit scary was when this voyage started was that Jim was giving these songs that we didn't exactly know how we could put into video form and make a music video of. That, you know, every song, of course, has a music video accompanying it. And the geniuses out at IPTV, Cameron McCoy, Teresa Knight, Delaney Howell, and Abby Brown, you know, they just helped produce these videos that bring these things that we didn't know that we could actually make come to life. But Pluto's Plight is one that's made out of animation, and I'm sure during season 3 there's going to be more animated adventures as well.
All right, well, we are going to go out here with Harley Hendrickson, Crossing Guard. But Dan Wardell and Jim Seek, thank you both so much for being here. It's Dr. Notable November, and you can see Dr. Notable's videos on the IPTV Kids Clubhouse website and on their YouTube channel. This is Talk of Iowa.
The farm was next to a freeway. The chickens couldn't cross the road in the midst of feathered pedestrians.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about music for kids. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll get some recommendations for some great new musical releases for kids. But with me now is Elaine Reschke-Hernandez. She's a doctoral student in music therapy at the University of Iowa. She is with me now. Hello, Elaine.
Hello. Thank you for having me, Charity.
Well, thank you so much for being here. And of course, it's no secret that most kids just seem to love music. And once they're old enough to start asking for it, they do. But we often start interacting with our kids musically right from birth when they're infants. I mean, what do we know about how music affects infants?
Sure. So, like you said, from day one, parents are interacting with their children using lullabies, especially, and then as they get a little bit older, play songs. And an interesting thing about lullabies is it seems to really help promote that bonding between the infant and their parents. And before babies are able to self-soothe or self-regulate their emotions, parents really help their children do that. And a big way that they do that is through lullabies.
Well, and I can imagine there are all kinds of things about singing to your baby. There's the vibration on the chest if you're holding your baby, and the warmth and the closeness and all of those things. But do we actually know, have we done, brain studies that show how the music seems to affect the brains of very young children?
So there's various research out there looking at that. What we do know is that infants from day one are able to distinguish between pleasing sounds or consonant sounds and dissonance, so less pleasing sounds. They're able to recognize familiar voices. And as they get a little older, they're able to distinguish more things such as major and minor or happy and sad, familiar tunes that they've heard before. And that all happens before age one or by age one. As far as brain studies, that's a bit out of my expertise with infants, but we do know that experience drives growth, and that great learning experiences can simultaneously promote development across multiple domains and provide multiple means for understanding. And what better way to do that than with something that is attractive and engaging and motivating? And there are so many different ways to engage with it, like music.
When people are becoming parents, they get a lot of advice, you know, about what they should do with their kids. And I remember when it became evident that in utero, children could actually hear from you know, a certain point on, that there, you saw the images of women with headphones on their baby bumps, you know. But a lot of the advice is, oh, children need classical music, or Mozart is what you need to play for children to help them develop. As a music therapist, what is your take on that? What kind of music do you play for kids?
Well, I think that there are a lot of marketing geniuses in the world. really, the best music is the music that your family connects with and enjoys. What music does your child respond to and engage with? I mean, we can make some really good choices about the message that music might carry with it, particularly with very young children. But as far as, you know, one composer being better than another, that's really just good marketing.
All right. And you mentioned that as children develop, I mean, obviously they start having opinions about, here's something I like, here's what I want to listen to, or I don't like that. As they grow, they also begin to understand emotionally the music. You mentioned being able to distinguish happy and sad. And you're not just talking about lyrics. You're talking about from the tone of the music, right?
Oh, absolutely. So one really important thing to remember about music is that we don't need words to convey a message or emotions in music. It can come from the timbre of our voice, the way it sounds, the selection of notes that we pick, the speed of the music, the energy in the music, all of those aspects of music can convey what we're thinking and feeling, and vice versa. You know, children are making music themselves very, very early on in life, and before they have use of words. And so that, I think that's a really important aspect of music to remember.
And how old are kids when they can obviously they have to be speaking. But when you can say, is that a happy song or a sad song? And they can identify maybe a minor key or a major key, that kind of thing.
So first you need to think about culture. So in Western culture, we would have major being more associated with happy mm-hmm. and minor more with sad. But so within a child's own culture, by age 3 or 4, once they have that vocabulary, you know, they can label a song as, oh, that sounds happy or that sounds sad.
Now, a lot of adults have concerns about their ability to make music. I never thought I was very good at singing, and, you know, sang a lot to my children when they were small in spite of that. But, I think for some grownups, it really gets in the way of making music for their children or singing to their children. What would you say to somebody who says, I can't sing, so I can't sing to my kids?
Well, it's interesting. At some point as we grow up, we start learning that, you know, only talented musicians can do music and entertain us. And it's more about aesthetics. And, you know, kids, it's just a part of human experience and exploring and experiencing the world. And, you know, making music with your children is just one more way of having a loving experience with them. And they really don't care if you can carry a tune or not. I mean, I can speak from my own family's experience. I apologize in advance to my husband, but he knows that he can't sing more than a couple of notes. And my kids absolutely love to hear him sing, and they have particular songs that they want to hear him sing. And I also will share with you a story. So we have a lot of very talented musicians in our music therapy program, and a lot of them babysit. And I will never forget one day this girl was sharing a story. Of course, she has a lovely voice. And she said the kids she babysat for did not want her to sing them a bedtime song. She started singing and they said, stop. I don't like it. You're not mom. And I think that's the message that parents should take is, you know, it just engage in it, and you're not on stage. You're just being with your kids.
There are studies about, you know, children making music and when they take music lessons and how that interacts with their brain. Beyond that, though, whether or not it's like a formal thing or just a spontaneous thing, why do you think it's important for children to have the opportunity to make music, not just to hear music or dance along, but to make music?
So when children have the opportunity to make their own music, they're really working on a lot of different skills that are non-music skills. So socially, music is so social. They're learning about their culture. If they're making music with other kids, they're learning about taking turns and cooperating with others and understanding other cultures. With language, they're practicing their language when they're making up their own songs. They're being creative. I know my son will often, he'll just hum his way through having his breakfast in the morning. My daughter will sing songs that don't necessarily make any sense, but she sings them to her stuffed animals. And, she is processing and expressing her thoughts and feelings. And then, of course, you mentioned movement, and obviously that works on physical and motor development. And then as kids get older, you know, having opportunities, increasing opportunities to express their emotions and be successful in engaging in something that they just enjoy doing.
You mentioned the social aspect of music. I want to talk more about that because I think it's easy to overlook that when we just think about, oh, I like this kind of music or I like this kind of song. What makes music such a social experience?
Well, I think if you just think about the history of music in human experience, I mean, it's so connected with pretty much every social experience we have. I mean, we have weddings, funerals, any kind of social gathering, rituals, and I think there's a lot we don't understand about music yet and why we have it in our lives, but just the fact that two people from two very different backgrounds and cultures can come together and engage and interact in music together, I think that's very powerful.
Well, and many parents have experienced the relief and release that bringing music to a very tired day can yes. bring you. When you're out of all other ideas, at least you can listen to music together, and it can be something you can do even if you're exhausted.
Absolutely.
As children get into school, of course, we have music classes. That's one of those programs that seems to perennially get cut. But so many kids get introduced to many different kinds of music and do have the opportunity to make music together in a group. Is that another important part of the social aspect, not just making music, but making music with other people?
Absolutely. And I think it's so sad every time I hear that music is being considered on the chopping block for budget reasons, because often music is the one place that kids are successful and they don't have to worry about, I'm not good enough. They're not put on sort of a they're not put on a pedestal, but they're also not criticized for not doing well, particularly if the music teacher focuses on those social aspects of, hey, we're here to learn from each other and learn with each other and create these experiences together.
So especially in elementary school, it sounds like you're saying it can be a great equalizer.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Now, you have done a lot of work in the past with children who are on the autism spectrum and music. How I know that as a music therapist, obviously that's an important part of what you do, but how can you use music to connect with kids that may be difficult to connect with in other ways?
Sure. So just like with typically developing children, when we engage in music, we're doing a lot of different things. As a music therapist, what I do is I think about how I can structure live music to help these kids be successful. So often I'll take away the words, or I might add a lot of repetition. One really wonderful thing about music is not only is it very flexible and structured, but you can add repetition and not get tired of it. And in fact, humans tend to like music better when it involves a certain degree of repetition. And so for kids who are on the autism spectrum, those listeners who aren't as familiar with this, they struggle with social skills and they struggle with structure and routine, and music in itself, it just provides that predictability and structure that's comforting. And because you can change how stimulating it is, and because you can change what type of instrumentation you use and how much language you use, you know, it provides a lot of opportunities for kids at various degrees of ability to engage and be successful.
As we grow, we've already talked about the fact that in elementary school, music can be a great equalizer. As we grow, we're not all equal in music, which is fine. Obviously, there are some young people and some adults who have incredible talent that not everybody can have. But it also sounds like you feel like it becomes too exclusive as we grow. What are your thoughts about that?
I mean, of course, this is my opinion, but I think that often in our society, we lose sight of the fact that music should be a fun experience. I mean, both of my children are in Suzuki lessons. That's largely because we just felt like it was a good thing for them to, all of the things that I've talked about before, just have another place for them to learn social skills and whatnot. But we don't expect them to be, you know, on a stage and grow up to be virtuosos on their instruments. We just expect them to learn that music is is fun. And if they're not having fun, then we say, well, what's the point? And every time we go visit one of our relatives' houses, we say, you know, why don't you pick one of the things you've been working on in your lessons to play? And if you don't want to play that, then just make something up. And it's, we just talk about music being a gift that they can give, and they don't have to spend money, and they can share that with everybody around them.
What is your advice for parents who maybe they have young kids, maybe they have older kids, as far as bringing music into their children's lives? What would be the one thing that you'd want parents to know?
Well, for I've talked a lot about younger kids. For older kids, I would say, you know, often parents don't like what their older kids listen to. Take time to find out why they like that music. You know, ask. Music is a huge part of adolescents' identities. And I think taking the time to demonstrate that you have an interest in that aspect of your kids' lives, it's really valuable. For younger kids, just being okay with putting on a CD, letting your kids pick out music, and having a dance party in the living room. Or if you have really young kids, you know, take a nod from them and make up a song along with them. And really, you're not on Carnegie Hall's stage, so it doesn't matter what it sounds like. Just have fun.
Right. Set aside the ego. Set aside
absolutely
the nerve. Well, and so many teachers incorporate music into their classrooms as well. I mean, it just seems like a wonderful vehicle for kids to learn at any age.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, teachers out there, use music for your transitions. Oh, my goodness. And it doesn't have to be Barney's cleanup song. Just make up your own cleanup song. Or there's a really wonderful group called Sweet Honey in the Rock that has a great cleanup song, too. You
good
can
advice.
Use.
All right. Well, Elaine, thank you so much for talking with me.
Absolutely. Thank you, Charity.
Elaine Reschke-Hernandez is a doctoral student in music therapy at the University of Iowa. We've been talking about the power of music as children develop and harnessing that power as well. Coming up in just a moment, we're going to get some recommendations for some great new musical releases for kids. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. These days, the world of children's music is as diverse as the world of music is. Stephen Shepherd is a music reviewer and blogger. You can find his thoughts on children's music and other media for kids at zooglobal.com. He lives in Phoenix. Stephen, thanks so much for being here.
You're welcome. Thanks so much for asking me, Charity.
And you are a dad. Your kids are now 12 and 16, so kids' music probably isn't their thing still. And this is not your day job. So tell me how you got started reviewing kids' music.
So my wife, when just after the birth of our first child, our daughter, was participating in a parents group, and she signed up for the newsletter committee and asked me to write music reviews on kids' music for the parenting group newsletter, even though I had never actually written a music review in my life. But like the good spouse I was, I said sure, and I wrote some reviews, and after two or three years, blogging became more of a thing, and I decided to move those reviews off sort of the plain paper newsletters and into the internet. And so I started posting them online, and I started writing new reviews. And by about 2006, that started to be when the internet made it much easier for artists to get their music into the world without sort of thinking about a label. It also happened to be the year that Jack Johnson soundtrack for The Curious George, Kidz Bop, High School Musical had the top three positions on the Billboard Top 200 Albums chart. So that was a big wake-up call for people that said, oh, people are interested in listening to music that is not just targeted at adults, but, you know, kids are also interested in listening.
Right, and they might even be willing to pay for it.
And they might be willing to pay for it.
Well, in the world of kids' music is interesting because you have sort of this generic kind of kids' music where you're in a store and there's a CD that it says, oh, songs for kids, and it has 30 songs, and the artists aren't necessarily listed, but it's a lot of people who sound like they're pretending to be children singing music that you probably know. And then there are the artists who are actually crafting music that they hope that children will love and connect with, and it's much more driven by their vision. So this is kind of a two separate worlds within kids' music, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. I remember sort of going through probably Baby Is R Us and sort of seeing a kids' music CD and getting it. This is probably when my wife was still pregnant, and listening to it and realizing, oh my goodness, this is just awful. And, you know, I sort of draw this distinction between music sometimes and books for kids, because nobody ever is surprised when they become a parent that people write books for kids. And there are authors who, you know, spend lifetimes sort of dedicating themselves to writing timeless or long-lasting books for kids. And I think for a long time, the number, or at least the percentage of people who were doing that in kids' music, I think was really low. And I think there are a number of people who are sort of thinking about it as, no, I actually consider myself a musician for kids, and they are the audience I'm most interested in, and I want to create something in a recorded product that will last.
Well, and I know parents who maybe they heard those CDs with those compilations of songs sung by anonymous artists pretending to be children, and said, you know what, my kids don't need kids' music. My kids can listen to the Beatles, and my kids can listen to show tunes, and my kid, you know, there's a lot of great music out there that resonates with kids. I don't need kids' music. So given that, because kids do love all kinds of music and will listen to a lot of different things, why do you think it's important to have music for kids?
I think there are a couple reasons. One is, I think sometimes the language that kids have, just depending on the age, just isn't as developed as the language that you and I have as parents. And so even listening to some songs, you know, Beatles songs, love songs, songs for adults, they're talking about concepts and words that kids might not fully understand. So that's one reason. I think a second reason is there's a whole wide range of experiences that kids have that I think is poorly served by what we think of as top 40 or even show tune radio. And so, I mean, we actually, you know, in our house, I remember listening to ABBA on drives, on Sunday drives with my parents. I didn't really listen to a lot of kids' music, we'd listen to ABBA. You know, we listen to Broadway musicals in our house as well. But, you know, we also listen to songs that are, you know, celebrating what it's like to sleep in on a Saturday morning, or, you know, songs celebrating different types of shapes, or things that are of direct interest to, say, a four-year-old that really aren't of interest to a 34-year-old. But why shouldn't the 4-year-old have books targeted at her concern? You know, nobody ever sort of says, oh, you know, Stephen King was good enough for me, it's good enough for my toddler. But I think sometimes, and I'm not saying that people who want to play their kids the Beatles are the equivalent of wanting to read Stephen King to their toddler, but I do think there's a lot of music that addresses the 90% of the world that isn't about love. And that's one of the things that I appreciate about kids' music, even as my own kids have, for the most part, aged out of the genre.
Absolutely. Well, and you brought us a selection, a really diverse selection of some recent things. So why don't we listen to one of the songs and talk about where you see it fitting in the world of children's music? This is Lucky Diaz and the Family Jam Band with a song called Palatero Man.
On the hottest day of the year, he rounds a corner, the kids all cheer.
Yay!
It's the Mexican ice cream man, selling his paletas to all he can. He's el paletero. He's el paletero man. He's el paletero man.
selling all his ice creams a todos los chiquillos. Oh yeah, my friends, can you hear the sound?
Just a little bit of Lucky Diaz and the Family Jam Band. Palatero Man. So tell me a little bit about this artist and where it's coming from.
So Lucky Diaz and his wife, Alicia Gaddis, they are together in this band. They are out of L.A., and their latest album is really a concept album about what it's like to live in Los Angeles. And so there are different songs that celebrate different parts of living in L.A. There's even a song about being stuck in traffic. But this song here is, you know, really celebratory about the Palatero Man who sells those popsicles. And I think one of the things I like about the song and why I think it's representative of a lot of new kids music is that it's bilingual. And so I think one of the things that's been a big growth area for the genre in the last 5 to 10 years is a lot more bilingual music. A lot of people are singing in They're doing all Spanish language albums or albums that mix both English and Spanish language. And unlike some albums that might sort of be very didactic in terms of, well, and here's how you count to 10 in Spanish. I mean, this song just sort of weaves in a lot of different Spanish language words without even really trying to explain them. They're just sort of naturally part of the song. And I think given the subject matter, I think it melds very nicely. It might sort of be a very didactic in terms of, well, and here's how you count to 10 in Spanish. I mean, this song just sort of weaves in a lot of different Spanish language words without even really trying to explain them. They're just sort of naturally part of the song. And I think given the subject matter, I think it melds very nicely.
Well, and the music is sophisticated. I mean, if you don't listen too closely to the lyrics, you don't necessarily know that this is meant for kids.
Right. No, I think a hallmark of the modern kids music that, you know, if you went through Babies R Us 15 years ago and looked for kids music, would have been all synthesized sounds, you know, somebody on a keyboard, whereas this is, you know, layered production and real instruments and, yeah, definitely not done on the cheap or slowly.
Well, and I think
or very quickly.
Right. I think one of the things that I don't know, for me as a mom, back when my kids listened more to kids music, one of the things that I found really interesting was how often I found myself singing the songs and how they, in fact, I still have a couple on my running playlist that my kids don't listen to anymore, but I still do. You know, the fact that these can appeal to people of all ages, although they are clearly directed to kids.
Yes. No, and I think if you talk to a lot of artists, they sort of think about it the same way. They will all say, I'm not writing for kids. I'm trying to write music that is just good music and happens to maybe be targeted to the kids in terms of subject matter. But they're certainly not trying to dumb down the musical production in any way.
Well, let's listen to another song. And this is classic song, a traditional song, Little Liza Jane. So it's something a lot of people will be familiar with, but it's performed by Jazzy Ash and really brings this song some new life.
I'm gonna teach you a little song I know I learned from round the way. It's a sing-along and here's your part. This is what you say. You sing Little Liza Jane. Try that.
Little Liza Jane.
Oh, yeah, Little Liza Jane.
Little Liza
One
Jane.
One more time, sing Little Liza Jane.
Little Liza Jane.
Little Liza Jane.
Why did you pick this song?
Well, Jazzy Ash, real name Ashley Cristobal, is another Los Angeles-based musician, but she has family roots in the New Orleans area, and so she has, in the course of her kids' music career, sort of focused on jazz and sort of particularly the sort of New Orleans style of jazz. And so one of the things I loved about this track is its energy, her voice, and just the way it mixes this very classic kids song with a new jazz background. I just I wish there were even more jazz albums for kids, but I'm happy that this one exists because it's just lots of fun and really joyful.
Well, and I love jazz myself, so I played my kids a lot of jazz music that could be for kids, but so many of the jazz standards are all about love. So I can you need this, something that kind of takes that out of the equation.
Yeah, and she in particular is very inspired by the queen of the living legend of kids music, Ella Jenkins. And, you know, she on the album sort of does a lot of songs that people might have heard Ella Jenkins sing on her classic albums. So I feel like it's celebrating Ella's music, but, you know, updating the sound so that it's, you know, it's a very vibrant, lots of different instruments joining in.
All right, so let's play something very different. This is from Steven Steven. It's called "A Fact Is a Gift That You Give Your Brain." A little bit of "A Fact Is a Gift That You Give Your Brain." Give me a little background on this.
Oh, I love this song. This band, Steven Steven, consists of two guys named Steve. One, Steve Burns, who you may remember from Blues Clues.
I do remember Steve from Blues Clues.
And the other is Steven Drozd, who is in The Flaming Lips. So you've got these two artists who, you know, Steve Burns never did kids' music while he was on Blue's Clues, and Stephen Drozd doesn't have a background in terms of kids' music, but they somehow hooked up with one another to create this band that the songs are on the album are so delightfully loopy and weird, but power poppy, which is sort of my own sort of personal musical sweet spot. And this song, I love the song. But it's also one of those things where, like, it's a great song, but if you, like, listen to the lyrics, I mean, they're telling you lots of stuff, but because the musical bed is so compelling, you're like, oh, I don't mind that they're telling me pieces of information. Whereas I think a lot of music that can be didactic feels didactic, yeah, because there's no imagination in the music itself, whereas this is just so catchy and melodic, you don't really mind that maybe you're learning something.
And parents everywhere are going to go around singing it whether they want to or not.
Exactly, and which I think has helped because, you know, as you can well appreciate, as you know, the kids will get stuck on a certain song or album, and that just means that the parent may need to listen to the song, 10, 15, 20 times. And so I think there's a degree of tolerance for repeated plays that kids' music sometimes has a much higher bar to clear than regular music. And so finding that album that you're like, oh, I don't mind listening to that again, is really, it's obviously important for the kid, but it can be very helpful to the parent.
Absolutely. Well, Stephen Shepherd, thank you so much for talking with me today.
You're welcome, Charity. Thank you so much for asking.
Stephen Shepherd is a music reviewer and blogger. You can find his thoughts on children's music and other media for kids at zooglobal.com. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.